This is special programming from North State Public Radio. I'm Tess Vigeland. Tonight on After Paradise, it's been 19 days since the campfire began its rampage. Rain is falling on the disaster site where search and recovery operations continued in an effort to find, in the ashes, the more than 200 people still listed as missing. Tonight we'll hear from the Federal Emergency Management Agency, from a local foundation that's collecting record donations for survivors, and the Butte County District Attorney shares what to watch out for as scams make their way into the post-disaster ecosystem. We also hope to answer questions from you. We have a dedicated phone line for you to leave questions and comments, and you can find that number on our website, mynspr.org. For Tuesday, November 27th, 2018, this is After Paradise. We turn first to the Federal Emergency Management Agency, which has distributed more than $20 million so far in the recovery effort. Three-quarters of that money has gone toward housing vouchers. Some 17,000 people have registered with the agency, the first step in getting help from the federal government. Frank Mansell is a spokesman for the agency.
Well, what people need to know today is if you've been in touch, if you've registered with FEMA, you're more than welcome to come down to the Disaster Recovery Center here in Chico, or there's a Disaster Recovery Center at Oroville on 2140 Feather River Boulevard. We're seeing about 1,500 people a day here that are coming in. They're coming in for either FEMA questions or FEMA case management. We're seeing people that have not registered yet, so it's a convenient place for people to come and register. We also have at this location a number of county, state agencies that are willing to help you reestablish your identity, help you find registrations for your vehicles that may have perished in the fire. We've got the IRS here. The post office will help you set up a box should you need it. So it's a one-stop shop for everything that you need to try and reestablish some normalcy to your life.
We have been seeing stories and hearing stories of long lines to meet with someone from FEMA. How many people do you have on the ground here, and is it enough?
We have a total of 104 staff in the field, meaning that they are deployed to the disaster. And for efficiency's sake, there is intake at the very front when you come in. You're given a ticket, you're asked to sit down. And the job is to thread you into the building as quickly as possible. The reason we do that is we need to keep track of the individuals that are coming here that are repeat customers and that are first-time customers. So once you get into the front door and released into the building, you're free to roam about for any number of these agencies, and the tables are all set up. And there are some lines that are longer than others, certainly the Butte County Assessor's office is a very long line. The lines at FEMA are being handled in two phases. So once you come in, there's a section of the store that is set aside for FEMA. One is to register, and the other is for case management. So, yeah, the line could fluctuate. It could be a very long line, and that could be due to the fact that the questions are complicated. It's really based on an individual, each individual's questions as to how long that line lasts.
We are also still seeing a lot of stories and hearing a lot of stories of people who do not have shelter. As you're aware, it's getting cold. What is the current status of FEMA's role in the housing situation, particularly when it comes to making trailers available to folks who don't have a place to stay?
Well, the housing focus of FEMA is to move people from shelters, which are still up. We had 550 folks in shelters as of last night. That's slowly declining. That's your first line of protection and sheltering. The second line is to move you into something that is called transitional housing. That would be something like maybe an apartment or a motel. Sometimes it's a travel trailer. Sometimes individuals who have home insurance generally have a long-term clause in their policy, which means that their insurance company will provide them with a lump sum to look after their housing immediately. If you don't have that, then FEMA will provide you a grant tide you over short term in one of these hotels. We do not have or will not be able to provide you the hotels. You're going to have to do that on your own, generally.
The issue that people are finding here, of course, is that this is an area that's full of small cities with not a lot of housing and not a lot of even hotel and motel rooms. So there are continuing questions about whether FEMA will be bringing in trailers, including the ones that are currently sitting in Sacramento.
Trailers are an option and are used in post-disasters. We have to look at where do you site the trailer, where do you put it, where do you have the sewer facilities, power facilities, and places where individuals can set up a trailer. They're certainly not going to be able to go back onto their site back in Paradise at this point because of the contamination of the property.
So is there any estimate of when you might be able to find a site on which to put those trailers?
Well, part of that is ongoing. You have some RV parks and some mobile home sites that were not damaged by the fire who have reached out to FEMA and said, I've got a site here that will take 40 units or 20 units. And we have it's a housing task force. And they are out searching for places to site these trailers. We're very early on in this process, and acquiring trailers is the least of the worries right now. It's more important that we find places to put them. So if you can bear with us while we look after that mission and find a place for these units. And again, not everybody is going to qualify, and there's no lineup. There's not a situation where you say to FEMA, I want a travel trailer. We will look at your individual situation, assess your needs. We certainly are not likely to put a family of six in a travel trailer. It's not conducive, and it's not appropriate. And it may be that the travel trailer may have to be placed 60 or 70 miles from here. And then is that conducive to your work? Is it conducive to your children to go to school? There are an awful lot of questions that have to be answered before you can say we're going to bring in travel trailers. In the meantime, we're going to have to rely on housing stock that's here.
Frank Mansell is a spokesperson for the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and he's been speaking with us from the shelter here in Chico. Frank, thank you.
Thank you, Tess.
We mentioned earlier the amount of money that FEMA has given out thus far, but that's far from the only source of help for fire victims. Donations have poured in from all over the country to various national and local aid organizations. Close to home, the North Valley Community Foundation is providing grants from the donations it's been receiving. Alexa Benson Valvanis is the foundation's president and CEO, and we spoke in her offices in downtown Chico.
Right now, the North Valley Community Foundation is engaged in our emergency response phase. So what we're doing is actively looking to our partners on the ground that are providing direct service to the evacuees and people displaced by the fire, and making sure the shelters have what they need, making sure the nonprofit organizations have what they need to provide this emergency response. And to what we're hearing is financial contributions are what's needed most at this time. Yesterday, the North Valley Community Foundation deployed another $500,000 in grants to those service providers. So we're just making sure that they have exactly what they need in terms of financial support to do what they do. That brings our total to $804,000 that we've deployed in the 2 weeks' time.
How does that compare to a normal period of time for you?
That would be months and months of work at the Community Foundation. So we've raised close to $8 million for the Camp Fire Relief Fund in the 2 weeks' time. And this is support not just locally, but support throughout the nation and internationally as well. Money is, in fact, pouring in to help with the evacuees and displaced people. And our role is simply to make sure that we are getting it to the organizations that are doing the best in terms of providing care and support for the evacuees.
How do you determine who is doing the best and is worthy of getting some of your funding?
One of the unique roles of a community foundation is to work with the nonprofit sector 365 days a year. So these are already our friends and partners. We know them very well and we trust them. So our vetting process is very quick because we have long-standing relationships with these organizations. Many of the makeshift shelters like the churches we also have relationships with as well. So we have a process by which they apply for funds. They let us know exactly how it's going to impact the folks displaced by the fire, and we're able to turn around grants very quickly for the support.
What are you seeing when you go out there to these organizations that are getting funding from you? What are they providing? What are people most in need of, aside from, of course, the organizations needing cash?
Well, it's just, it's devastating. You know, anybody that's been here at any point during this crisis knows that the trauma is so severe. So I think we're just learning what people need. We start with, do they have shelter? Do they have a safe place to be? Are they in an environment where they have food and care and hopefully some mental health services as well? Is there a place for their children to go during the day for the parents to have respite? Do we know entirely what they need? We have no idea. We're just learning. The severity of this disaster is something I don't think we've ever seen before. An entire town was obliterated, and so many surrounding communities were impacted. So we are just assessing day by day what the nonprofit organizations and service providers need. They're telling us, and we're responding with resources for them. And we're here for the long run. So our Campfire Relief Fund will move to a recovery phase shortly, and we will have a heightened focus on housing to help assist FEMA and the other county and the other entities that are going to be helping with this solution.
For those who are hearing this and want to know how they can make a difference, what's your advice?
We have the Campfire Relief Fund. We charge 1%, so 99 cents on the dollar is going to be deployed either in the emergency response phase or in the long-term recovery phase. It will go directly to those impacted by this fire. They can make a contribution there at nbcf.org. If they have a charity that they love and want to support, I just encourage them to go directly to that organization, whether it's the United Way, whether it's their church that's opened the doors, whether it's the Red Cross that's on the ground helping facilitate these shelters. Those are all good uses of their resources. If they want to give to an organization that's going to be here for the long run, long after the emergency response, I think the Campfire Relief Fund at the Community Foundation is a good decision.
Alexa, thank you very much.
Of course, thank you.
You're listening to After Paradise, a special production from North State Public Radio. More just ahead. This is After Paradise, a special program on the aftermath of the campfire from North State Public Radio. I'm Tess Vigeland. Escaping a disaster like the campfire is traumatic, and many in our community are now at risk for post-traumatic stress disorder because of the disturbing and painful memories locked in their heads. But what many people don't know is that with the proper help, some may be able to avoid the debilitating effects of PTSD. A local group of therapists known as the Northern California Trauma Recovery Network is giving away free therapy sessions to campfire survivors in an effort to help them recover without succumbing to PTSD. Reporter Sarah Bohannon has more.
The therapy is called Eye Movement Desensitization Reprocessing, or EMDR therapy, and it's a lot different than just going to a therapist and talking about the event. It mimics the REM cycle of sleep that humans naturally go through. During the REM cycle, a sleeping person experiences a quicker pulse and heartbeat and more dreaming and body movement, but they also experience rapid eye movements. These help the brain process memories that were created earlier that day. According to Penny Suhignal, the director of the Northern California Trauma Recovery Network, if a trauma occurs, the brain can stop processing those memories around the experience. If that process stops for a long time, PTSD can develop. She says how EMDR therapy works is it mimics the rapid eye movements that happen during sleep, allowing the brain of the affected person to process the traumatic memory.
By initiating eye movement through our hands going back and forth or headphones on with bilateral stimulation of the brain or tapping, it initiates the parasympathetic nervous system, which helps them be calmer while they're going through the process. And then it actually takes the aspects of memory of that trauma, image, knowledge, thoughts, sense of self, emotions, body sensations. It lights up all those aspects of memory in the brain, brings those aspects together to the hippocampus, consolidates the memory together, and then adapts it. So we're initiating the natural process that a person's brain goes through at night. And by doing that, they don't end up with PTSD.
Hignal says her clients report feeling better immediately after a session, and even more importantly, that they don't have to be traumatized by the event anymore.
So in other words, what I mean, take a fire victim, the sound of a fire engine. That sound of that fire engine causes all those aspects of memory around the original trauma to light up in the brain, and they get what they could feel like would be like a panic attack. It's a response. And it is very difficult for them to stay in the here and now. They really are in the here and now, but they feel like they're back in the fire. And it sometimes takes a few days for that feeling to resolve. What we do is we get rid of that response. And they're able to then think about the fire and not have that traumatic response in their brain.
Hignal says everyone who has been through the campfire should seriously consider getting EMDR therapy and that they should do so as soon as possible. She says PTSD usually develops in about 3 to 6 months.
Some of the symptoms are nightmares, not wanting to be around anything that reminds them of the original trauma, hypervigilance, having all of a sudden a panic attack when the trauma has gotten initiated in the brain, isolation, withdrawal, depression. So as you can see, there's a lot of symptoms that a person can have.
The Northern California Trauma Recovery Network currently has 70 therapists who are trained in EMDR therapy. They're giving up to 5 free therapy sessions for campfire victims. But Hignal says they're also working with first responders.
In our TRN here in the Northern California area, we really have a heart for the first responders. Many times they're just left off to the wayside and their needs aren't met. But I don't want by saying that that we aren't wanting to meet the needs of other people. We are. For a citizen that wants it or any agency that has people that want it, we're ready.
To learn more, or if you're a campfire survivor who wants to sign up for free EMDR therapy sessions, head to mynspr.org. For North State Public Radio News, I'm Sarah Bohannon.
One of the more enraging aspects of post-disaster life is the proliferation of scam artists trying to take advantage of victims. Unfortunately, the campfire is no exception. Reporter Mark Albert spoke with Butte County District Attorney Mike Ramsey about how to avoid being a victim a second time. He started the conversation by asking the district attorney about people who present themselves as insurance expediters.
As the insurance commissioner indicated, that he has instructed and cajoled and has told insurance companies, let's not nickel and dime folks in this disaster. Let's not say, okay, now give me a list of everything that you think you had. Most insurance companies, most good insurance companies, are just giving the limit of the insurance and just saying, no need to give us that. We know you've lost everything, so here's the limit of your policy. Here's a settlement, and you don't need someone that's going to take 10 or 15% of that settlement right off the top for you.
Now, there are schemes that impact people at all economic levels, but are there different types of scams that impact those on the edge versus those that have more resources?
I would say that some of the gouging is obviously those folks that can least afford it, that are gouged in terms of for cost of, say, water or gas or rental. And that's going to be a real issue with 15-20% of our housing inventory gone. That's obviously even worse.
Housing rental scams, Craigslist, Facebook Marketplace, Airbnb. How does this work? Someone finds a vacant house and then presents themselves as a rental broker and offers keys for a deposit or makes up excuses. What would be some clues that you were dealing with someone who's unscrupulous or isn't effectively a broker or an agent for the property owner?
Yeah. First of all, they'll be asking you to meet someplace other than their office because they don't have an office. Second, it's has indicated that it is an extraordinarily good price, particularly in this heated market. You're not going to get extraordinarily good prices. And they will be trying to do a very quick deal. Come on, it's going. I like you. I understand your family situation. You're the perfect family to get in here. Let's do this right now. Just give me that $400. I'll get you this key, and it's right over here. And quite frankly, they have no ability to rent out because they have no connection to this particular rental.
So the hard sell.
Exactly.
Contractors are always a big issue. Perhaps you've signed a contract. How does one avoid getting into a deal with a fraudulent contractor or someone who's presenting themselves as a contractor?
Right. First thing to do is to check and make sure that they have a license. And one really easy way to do is let's see your pocket license. That's like a little driver's license that says this is a certified, this is a licensed contractor in California. Also checking on the Contractor State License Board, a regulatory board in the state for contractors to see if they're on that list. People, also contractors that are going to, if you have big job is try to get you to pay more than the $1,000 up front to get to start doing things. You would have the contractor says, listen, I've got lots of jobs here, and I'm going to need more money to start your job over these other jobs. Give me upfront $10,000. Real clue, say thank you, goodbye, and report it to us.
So if someone's asking for more than $1,000 or more than 10% of the total cost of the job up front, run.
Run the other way and report them, please.
Here's something else that has started to pop up. It looks like one of those regular town hall meetings. It's organized, though, by some attorneys, and it is all over social media. Are people potentially about to sign away their rights to being compensated for their losses?
Correct. Anytime that you sign up into a class action lawsuit, I'm not saying that class action lawsuits aren't very good in dealing with major cases, but understand in a major class action, it's going to be years before you see any sort of money that's going to come back. And perhaps it's better to talk to your local attorney or talk to someone to have a better idea. Don't just jump at the first element.
Mark Albert speaking with Butte County District Attorney Mike Ramsey. The number to call to report suspected price gouging or other issues is 1-866-DA-FRAUD. NSPR's Dave Schlom has a deep personal connection to Paradise, California. And professionally, he's been researching the causes and triggers of wildfires. Those two worlds combined in the devastating campfire.
Everywhere I go in the North State, I overhear the conversations. They usually feature these words, lost everything. The unfortunately named campfire has put the entire area in a state of shock. I'm lucky. I have a roof over my head and a vocation. But my memories of Paradise haunt me because it was my home for many years. I spent my summers in Paradise with family beginning in 1968 before moving there permanently in 1977. I'll never forget the moment I got out of a car after a long drive from LA. It was 2 a.m. and I looked up with my 8-year-old eyes. Set against the silhouette of pines was something I'd never truly seen, a dark night sky and the Milky Way. My summer days were spent fishing the nearby creeks and cutting firewood with my brother. Paradise was beautiful with majestic old ponderosa pines, lovely flowering dogwoods, and apple orchards. When I first arrived, I think there were 3 stoplights, 2 of them pretty new. The population density was low. It was a mountain town. It was home. My children were born there, my parents passed away there, and my granddaughter was just born there a few weeks ago. The climate was great, too. Real estate agents sold it as a place above the fog and below the snow. That was back when it was foggier in the valley and snowier in the mountains. But that, too, has changed. For many years, I owned a horse in Paradise and used him as a secondary mode of transportation. I remember epic rides down into the canyon of the West Branch of the Feather River, over Sawmill Peak and into Lake Concow, and back. I keep thinking about that since that was the same route the embers of the campfire took decades later. I worked for the local papers, the Ridge Gazette and later the Paradise Post. I was the sports writer there in the early 80s and got to know many of the wonderful educators and coaches at Paradise High School. I had a paper route too, the upper part of Paradise, Magalia, and virtually all of the Upper Ridge. In the past weeks, I haven't been able to get my mind to stop replaying that paper route and all the little homes tucked away in the trees that I know are mostly gone now. As the 80s wore on, I went to CSU Chico and got my degree in geosciences. Paradise was starting to burst at the seams with more and more development. The little apple orchards were mostly gone, replaced by housing and shopping centers. You couldn't really see the Milky Way from town anymore. And of course, there was always talk of what would happen if a fire came to the ridge. Too many people, too few evacuation routes. Lucky for me, I left Paradise and moved to Tehama County, where I teach at Corning High School. A few weeks ago, I was teaching a lesson on the mega fires that have devastated California, telling the students that Paradise scared me more than anywhere. We discussed the 4 major causes for these fires: a decade of punishing drought that's dried and stressed the vegetation, the wildland-urban interface, places like Paradise where people want to live in the hills surrounded by forest, more than a century of poorly managed fuels that should have been burned in small fires frequently, and finally, the layer of climate change that some public officials choose to either deny or at best sidestep. But it's a fact that the average year-round temperature in California has increased, a gut punch to drought-stressed plants. There is hopeful talk of rebuilding Paradise, and people will naturally want to return. But should they? And if so, will it be a truly fire-resilient community, or just develop to get folks back into their homes as quickly as possible? These are hard issues to deal with. If a new Paradise rises from the ashes, I hope they plant more apple orchards than shopping centers.
Dave Schlom can be heard on Blue Dot every Friday at 10 a.m. And that is our program for Tuesday, November 27th, 2018, 19 days since the fire started. We're produced by Sarah Bohannon, Mark Albert, and Phil Wilkie. The music for this program was composed by Adam Ragusea. Special thanks today to John Sepulvedo. Again, we want to hear from you, your stories, your questions. Leave us a message at 530-433-4887. We may play it on the air. You can also find us online at mynspr.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. Tell us what you need to know. Tomorrow, a money manager who lived through Hurricane Katrina shares lessons learned about how to handle post-disaster finances. Thanks for being with us. I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is After Paradise from North State Public Radio.